The torch would be passed from show to show. The Beverly Hillbillies to All in the Family to The Cosby Show to Roseanne. People, it seems, would rather watch a family than spend time with their own. It even helps to have the word family in the title. Family Ties, Family Affair, Family Guy, Family Matters. Mike Nichols even produced a series that was just called Family. But that last one was a flop. I trust the stupid audiobook editor will remember to take that out. Chapter 13, A Development Deal with the Devil. After the failure, resurrection, and refailure of The Critic, Al Jean and I decided to cash in on our lack of success. We got a development deal. Development deals were a phenomenon where a studio would pay you a lot of money to create TV shows for them exclusively. The studios would then sell the shows to networks, the shows would fail, as 95% of shows do, and everyone would lose money. Eventually, the studios realized that they would save money by not making TV shows, so they would shoot down virtually any idea pitched to them. Years later, they finally figured out that they'd save even more money by not making development deals at all. The whole business model faded away, a quaint relic of the 1990s, like Hulk Hogan or Unbiased News. Hal and I met with several studios about making a deal. At DreamWorks, Steven Spielberg himself sat down with us. He said, "I love The Critic, but you hold John back. Let Lovitz be Lovitz." I quipped, "Steve, I think I know a little more about directing than you do." The joke played to utter silence, and we didn't get the DreamWorks deal. Al and I made a 3-year development deal with another studio. Over the next 36 months, we pitched them more than 100 series ideas, none of which they bought. One we really liked was called 40 Below. It was about a team of research scientists stuck at a base at the South Pole. 10 years before The Big Bang Theory and 16 years before Frozen, we had a sitcom that combined them both. And drawing off what we learned at The Simpsons, we did our homework, reading every book we could find about Antarctica. When we finished our pitch, the studio executive had one suggestion. Set it at the North Pole. I told him we couldn't, and he asked, "What's the difference?" "It's literally all the difference in the world," I explained. "There's land at the South Pole. The North Pole is all ice and water. You can't build a base there." He let this sink in and then said, "I still think it should be the North Pole." "Why?" I asked, exasperated. And he said, "It's a funnier pole. 40 Below never went anywhere." Al and I continued to do good work during this time, just not on our development deal. We were moonlighting at The Simpsons, producing episodes on the side with a separate crew of writers. We did some pretty good shows, including Simpson Tide, Homer and Bart on a Navy sub, Simpson Califragilistic Expialidocious, our Mary Poppins parody, and The Springfield Files, our crossover with The X-Files. The last idea had been gathering dust at The Simpsons for 4 years, the longest development of any episode in history. Back at the studio, after 2.5 years of rejection, we decided to take the hack writer approach. We combined 2 successful shows to form a third one. We went to ABC with the idea for Teen Angel. We said, "It's a cross between Beavis and Butthead and Sabrina the Teenage Witch." "We love it," said the ABC executives, pleased we were finally getting it. "But we don't like the Beavis and Butthead angle." "So you want it to be a cross between Sabrina?" I asked. They nodded. And that's what we gave them, the story of a teenage boy whose best friend dies and comes back as a mischievous guardian angel. It was like The Odd Couple, but with a funny new twist, teen death. We found wonderful actors for the 2 teens, but for the role of the mother, ABC insisted we cast Maureen McCormick, the actress who played Marcia Brady. Maureen is a lovely lady and a very good actress, but she just looked too young. She was playing the mother of a teenager, and she still looked like a teenager. It gave the show a creepy, hillbilly incest vibe. But ABC insisted we hire her. 12 episodes later, ABC insisted we fire her. 5 episodes after that, they canceled the show. We had a team of talented writers who would go on to do much better things, like Frasier and Big Bang Theory. But Teen Angel had this feeling of crushing gravity. It was an ABC show on TGIF, This Garbage is Feeble. And as hard as we worked, we couldn't escape planet mediocrity. My name sometimes appeared 3 times on an episode, as creator, writer, and producer, and even I couldn't stand the show. The fans have been kinder to Teen Angel. The show scores a 7.4 on IMDb. That puts it in a tie with The Critic and just a skosh below Cheers, which gets a 7.8. I had one other job during my dismal development deal. I was a consulting writer on Homeboys in Outer Space, a sci-fi parody about bumbling interstellar delivery men. It was a cross between Futurama and, well, it was really just Futurama 3 years before Futurama. Pure coincidence. No one would knowingly rip off Homeboys. The show's creator, Eric Van Lowe, assembled an amazing staff of newcomers. 4 of them would become founding writers on Family Guy and later create American Dad. Actor Kevin Michael Richardson and writer Mike Price went from Homeboys to The Simpsons. And when Homeboys from Outer Space premiered, the Los Angeles Times called it the best new comedy of the season. And then the executives got involved. They shot down every story pitched to them and assigned us a supervisor who told us, "I come from soap operas. I don't get comedy." This once promising show was canceled after 21 episodes and wound up on TV Guide's list of 50 worst shows of all time. To recap, the studio executives turned the best new comedy into the worst of all time in under 1 year. Thank you for your service. Al Jean put it best. A development deal is where a studio pays you a lot of money for the privilege of ruining your career. I quit. Following our development debacle, Al Jean and I amicably ended our 17-year partnership. He went right back to The Simpsons. I quit show business, vowing never to return. I'd seen the development process close up and believed nothing of quality could ever come out of it. For 15 years, I'd followed the classic career trajectory. Staff writer, producer, showrunner, development deal, and finally series creator. And I found it got less and less fun at every step. I thought I'd never write again. I traveled the world with my wife, went to museums and movies, and just enjoyed myself. I had enough money to last me the rest of my life unless I wanted to eat or live indoors. And yet I couldn't stop writing. It wasn't for money or prestige or career advancement. It was just something I did. I wrote whatever I felt like. Children's books, New Yorker pieces, short stories, editorials. And every bit of it got rejected. I amassed 150 rejection letters in my first year of semi-retirement. I thought about giving up, wouldn't you? And then I read about Jack London, the best-selling, most translated author of his time. Before he got published, he racked up a pile of rejection letters on a spindle 3 feet tall. And then slowly, I started getting acceptances. All my New Yorker rejects were published in Esquire. One of those pieces wound up in a textbook on how to write humor. Screw you, shouts and murmurs. My book, How Murray Saved Christmas, was read and rejected by a dozen children's book publishers. But then I found my lucky 13th. They published the book everyone else had read and rejected. It was a massive hit. In a business where 9,000 sales makes a bestseller, this book sold 160,000 copies. It later became an animated holiday special. Since then, I've continued to write projects that I've truly believed in. I've sold 18 children's books and 8 movie scripts, and I've punched up 2 dozen animated films. It's all been fun, and I'm earning just what I used to make on the Hollywood treadmill. My lesson to young comedy writers is to avoid the traditional path and do the work you love. Or don't. This may work out horribly for you. Anyway, writing for TV was a huge part of my career, but it was only half my life. What follows is the second half. The boring half. Al Jean on my retirement. When Mike said he was retiring, what he was retiring from was running a show day to day. I think that bothered him a lot. When we were on Teen Angel, we would literally have like a dozen people giving us notes on episodes. Contradictory notes. Notes that contradicted what the person himself had said a week earlier. I think that's what set him off. He just got more tired of dealing with that than I did. At The Simpsons, it's a very different type of situation. You're just getting notes from Jim Brooks and Matt Groening, basically. Burning question. What is the secret of The Simpsons' success? The true secret to The Simpsons' success is the valuable input of network executives. We don't have any. When it was greenlit, Jim Brooks decreed that no studio or network exec would be allowed anywhere near the show. When we record The Simpsons, any bum off the street is allowed to come in and watch, but the president of Fox is not allowed in. Until he gets fired and becomes a bum on the street. Approximately 80% of LA's homeless population is former network presidents. One time I was directing the actors on The Simpsons, and the president of Fox came by with his little boy. The president said, "I know I'm not allowed in here, but can my son watch for a little bit?" And I said, "Sure, fine." The boy was very politely watching the show, and Jim Brooks came in and said, "Who's the kid?" I told him it was the network president's son. Jim got very angry. He didn't even want executives' kids in the room. And that's when I told a lie I'm not proud of. I said, "Jim, he's deaf." Who are network executives? People who meddle in every part of the creative process. People who get paid to turn junk into crap. I first saw these guys back in the 80s. There were 3 executives who ran all of ABC. They would go from show to show to see if producers were doing coke. And if so, was it good and where could they get some? 20 years later, I was back at ABC doing another sitcom. Now I had 11 executives working full-time on my show alone. They would bombard me with helpful suggestions like, "Does the rabbi have to be Jewish? How do the zombies feel about being zombies? And could you make Satan more likable?" And 11 executives is not the most I've seen. When you do a show with a big star, executives start multiplying like cockroaches. My apologies to cockroaches. My friend did a pilot for a red-hot comic, and every day he had to send copies of the script to 45 executives. I scanned the list and told him, "3 of the people on this list are dead. Every day you're sending scripts to 3 dead people." He replied, "I wish more were." And with all this help, a big star and 45 mostly living executives giving their input, how did the show do? It never got past pilot. As Jerry Seinfeld would ask, "Who are these people?" Network executives are largely MBAs with no experience in writing or producing, telling writers and producers how to do their jobs. You must take their notes, no matter how moronic. And the number of moronic notes they've given over the years would fill a book. I know this because there is such a book. It's called A Martian Wouldn't Say That, and it's 96 pages of actual studio notes. The title is something an executive said on the set of My Favorite Martian. Of course, there's still plenty of great TV out there. Not on the big networks, but on HBO, AMC, Netflix. These are places that hire creative people, then back off and let them do their jobs. When writer, director, actor, masturbator Louis C.K. pitched his brilliant show Louis to FX, they told him, "We'll give you $200,000 to make each episode, or $300,000 if you let us give notes." Louis said, "I'll take the $200,000." Chapter 14. Doing animated films for cash, not credit. Animated films can take years to make, giving producers endless chances to rethink, recast, revise, and test the film before audiences. The original screenwriter is often unavailable or unwilling to make these changes, so the work is done by some anonymous hack. Meet the anonymous hack. I've done punch-up and rewrites on animated films too numerous to mention. All right, I'll mention them. Despicable Me and Despicable Me 2, Minions, The Secret Life of Pets, all five of the Ice Age movies, The Lorax, Horton Hears a Who, Kung Fu Panda 3, Rio, Rio 2, Rango, Robots, Epic, Romeo and Juliet, Hop, Everyone's Hero, and The Simpsons Movie. My films have had a worldwide gross of $11 billion. I'm bigger than Pixar, baby. I also wrote the Ice Age Christmas Special. If you're wondering how you can set a Christmas special 10,000 years before Christ, well, you just do. I'm a handyman called in when things go wrong. Sometimes I'm sent a list of jokes in the script that need to be funnier. Other times they ask for a whole new scene to clarify a story or round out a character. Then there are times they just send the whole script and say, "Save it." I contributed a lot to Despicable Me, including the final scene where the villain, Gru, reads a bedtime story. I also wrote every kid's favorite line where Gru unveils his evil plan. "I fly to the moon. I shrink the moon. I grab the moon. I sit on the toilet." But my most lasting contribution was to Despicable Me's minions. I gave the little bastards names. Throughout the script, Gru would always refer to them collectively as boys. But I thought it would be funny to address them each by name, since to me, they were alike as a pile of little yellow Advils. In order to contrast their weirdness, I gave them bland white guy names. I chose from the blandest white guys I know, Simpsons writers. I used the first names of staff members like Kevin Curran, Stuart Burns, Bob Bennetson, and about 10 others. None of this seemed like a big deal until the Minions movie came out years later. Each poster for the film featured a single minion with the slogan, "Meet Kevin," or "Meet Stuart," or "Meet Bob." I couldn't tell them apart, but the kids could. It's like how my father felt about the Beatles. Often, rewriting can be frustrating work. Although filmmakers know they're in trouble and they're paying me to help, they're still reluctant to fix what's broken. The producer of Horton Hears a Who came to me and said, "There's a line in this film that makes me sick. I literally want to vomit every time I hear it. Can you do better?" Can I write something better than an emetic? You bet I can. I gave him 20 alternatives to the line, and yet, when I attended the premiere of the film, I saw that line was still in there. I swear I heard the producer barfing in the balcony. The line, if you're curious, was something an imaginative child said about a clover. "My best friend Thidwick lives on that." I did write a line that came after it. "In my world, everyone's a pony, and they all eat rainbows and poop butterflies." I tend to write a lot of toilet jokes for these films, and by God, they always get in. On the next film I worked on, no matter what I wrote, the script never changed. I tried to quit repeatedly, telling the producers, "You don't need to use my jokes, but you need to use somebody's." Each time they begged me to stay, saying they really needed the work I was doing. When the film wrapped, I found out there were 19 other writers working on the script at the same time. 19! When they were starting a sequel to the film, I said, "No thanks." 2 years later, I got a heartfelt call from the producer saying, "We're finishing the sequel and it's just not working. It needs the Mike Reiss touch." That's a phrase never used before or since. He went on, I know there's been some bad blood in the past, but we wondered if you might come on board and help us. I was touched. I said, I'd be happy to do it. I'll even do it for free. That's another phrase never used before or since. I went on, but you know that long list of thanks at the end of every movie, where you thank Dollar Rent-A-Car and the state of Georgia and the assistant studio nurse? Put me on the thanks list. The producer called me back the next day. No deal, he said. I wrote the greatest joke in my career for The Lorax. In that film and the Dr. Seuss book that inspired it, people are obsessively buying something called Thneeds. There are billboards reading Thneed all over the film. So I suggested at the end of the movie, The Lorax move the N in Thneed to the right, so it now reads The End. Perfect, right? It's the kind of joke writers call a find. Remember the one out there waiting to be discovered? The Lorax producer loved the joke, animated it, put it in the film, took it out of the film, and replaced it with nothing at all. Why? I'll never know. For some reason, studios will use any excuse to avoid putting in a new joke. Here's some of the best excuses I've heard. My 3-year-old won't get it. It won't translate into Portuguese. That joke will lose us $100 million in Korea alone. Note, no film has ever grossed $100 million in Korea. And the most popular excuse, we can save it in animation. Oh, that line. Cartoon directors believe they can make a bad joke work by adding a grace note after a failed punchline. A long pause, a character blinks, a fish tank bubbles, a bit of snow falls off a tree. You can see it all over Romeo and Juliet, a fine piece of family entertainment from Harvey Weinstein. Former Simpsons director Jim Reardon bears this out. After he left our show, he went off to work on classic animated features like Zootopia, Wreck-It Ralph, and WALL-E. He co-wrote the last one and got an Oscar nomination for his script. I asked Reardon if he learned anything from his Simpsons experience. He said, you taught me that if a joke doesn't work, cut it. He said other animators killed themselves trying to save a bit that just wasn't funny. Why do studios hire consultants when they're so loath to use their work? I suppose it's like asking for advice. You're hoping the answer will be, here's an easy fix to make everything all right. Or even better, don't change a thing. You're perfect. Any input offered beyond that is not welcome at all. Of all the films I've been part of, the toughest job I ever had was on an animated film called Everyone's Hero. You don't remember it? It was about the bickering relationship between a baseball, played by Rob Reiner, and a bat, played by Whoopi Goldberg. That's why you don't remember it. I spent 6 months writing snappy banter for these two. For example, the baseball says, suck my stitches, and the bat says, bite my knob. That's about it. When the movie came out, nobody in America saw it. Nobody in Europe saw it. The original director died before the film came out, so even he didn't see it. Everyone's Hero was no one's movie. A few years later, my wife and I were visiting Iran. Why? Because our idea of a vacation is most people's idea of a hostage situation. If refugees want to get out of a place, we want to go there. Anyway, in every city and village in Iran, in every shop and market stall, vendors were selling bootleg DVDs of this film. One day we climbed a mountain outside of Tehran. At the top of that mountain was a cave. At the back of that cave was a blind Muslim cleric standing by a wooden table. He was selling two things, copies of the Quran and DVDs of Everyone's Hero. This movie is the reason Iran hates us. If working on that film was a forgettable experience, working on Ice Age was a remarkable one. The series was created by a brilliant woman named Lori Forte. I'd known her years before when she was a network executive on ALF. Lori treats writers with respect, never piling them onto a project. There are only five or six of us who write all these films, and none of us mind that we're rewriting each other's work. And when a joke needs fixing, it gets fixed. I like to think this has helped make Ice Age the most successful animated franchise of all time, bigger than Toy Story and Trek. Weirdest of all, the biggest hit was the third one, Ice Age Dawn of the Dinosaurs. When I saw that title, I told the producer, there were no dinosaurs in the Ice Age. They'd been dead for 65 million years. The producer said, nobody knows that. So I plugged away at the script for a year, occasionally dropping in dialogue like, why are there dinosaurs in the Ice Age? And I thought these guys were extinct. Those lines always got cut. Nobody knows that, the producer told me again. 2 weeks before the film came out, the studio had a test screening of the film. 10 minutes into the movie, a little boy shouted, why are there dinosaurs in the Ice Age? But the producers were right. None of this hurt the film. Ice Age Dawn of the Dinosaurs was a success in America. Overseas, it was the third biggest film of all time, behind Titanic and Lord of the Rings Return of the King. When reporters asked why the movie was so successful, the filmmakers all had the same answer. We have no friggin' idea. The best explanation I heard came from another one of my fun vacations, the Ukraine. I'd gone to visit Chernobyl for Simpsons research. Yes, it's their hottest tourist attraction in every sense of the word. Afterward, I went to a park in Kiev that was filled with statues of Scrat, the Ice Age squirrel who's always pursuing an acorn but never quite getting it. I asked the Ukrainian woman why they love Scrat so much. She said, he teaches children that life is hopeless. Chapter 15, The Sleazy Nasty World of Children's Books. Something happened a few years ago that I couldn't believe. The Pope endorsed The Simpsons. Pope Benedict, the German pontiff who sort of resembled Mr. Burns, called our show the most Christian and moral show on television. It made me wonder if he'd ever actually seen the series. We'd just done an episode where Homer got sodomized by a giant panda. And it was our Christmas show. The Simpsons had clearly come a long way. When the show premiered in 1989, it was condemned by church groups across America, until someone pointed out that the Simpsons were the only family on TV that actually went to church. Our first season was also panned by First Lady Barbara Bush, who called the show the dumbest thing I've ever seen. Hey lady, look at your kids! I took all this criticism very personally, thinking I was bringing about America's moral decay. So I decided to write children's books. This was a stretch for me because I hate children. But Dr. Seuss hated children. So did Hans Christian Andersen. Lewis Carroll loved children in a way that's illegal in 48 states. I mentioned this in the lecture and someone asked, what are the two states where it's okay? That's how I met R. Kelly. Since then, I've published nearly 20 children's books. Choosing my favorite would be like picking which of my children I love the most. There are some I like much more than others, and a few I can't stand at all. My best book, the sweetest, most educational, and most inspiring, is called The Boy Who Looked Like Lincoln. The idea for the book came to me in a dream one night. It's the story of an 8-year-old boy who looks exactly like Honest Abe. He's got the hat, he's got the beard, he's got the wart. Other children make fun of him, so his parents send him to a camp for kids who look like things. There's a boy who looks like a frog, a girl who looks like a toaster, and 4 kids who look like Mount Rushmore. In the end, he learns it's not important what you look like, what matters is who you are. This doesn't explain why supermodels make so much more than school teachers, but what the hell, it's just a kid's book. I hoped it would provide comfort to ugly children everywhere. And there are a lot of ugly kids out there. I know, I've been to Chuck E. Cheese. The book was beautifully illustrated by David Catro, a man who's done 7 of my books. Our partnership is like a marriage, no communication whatsoever. I've never met the guy, never talked on the phone with him, I don't even know his email. Publishers keep authors and illustrators completely separated, and that may be a good thing. Another artist once lent me some of his sketches for an upcoming book. I told him I loved everything in this story except the little boy. He looked effeminate and always had his mouth open in an astonished "Oh." "Frankly, the kid looks like a gay sex doll," I said. "That's my son," he replied. I was very proud of the boy who looked like Lincoln right up to the moment the hate mail started pouring in. A school in Springfield, Massachusetts wrote to tell me they'd remove my book from their library. A minister in Iowa burned the book in his church parking lot. This is not as bad as it sounds. Before they burn it, they've got to buy it. Finally, the Texas State Board of Education banned my book. I was shocked, shocked to learn Texas had books. Lee Harvey Oswald knew it was safe to shoot Kennedy from the Dallas School Book Depository because no Texan would willingly walk into a warehouse full of books. The Texas ruling explained the anger readers felt towards this book, claiming it contained profanity and sexual content. What? Where? On the last page, the boy who looks like Lincoln hopes he can help his little brother Dick, a baby who, it turns out, looks exactly like Richard Nixon. But the Texas censors assumed the baby was named Dick because he looked like, well, you get it. They couldn't tell our 37th president from male gonads. Now, I'll admit that Dick Nixon did resemble a dong. His phallic nose, his testicular jowls. It could be why we remain simultaneously repulsed and fascinated by the man. But Penguin Books has not stayed in business for more than a century by ending children's books with full frontal male nudity. The baby in my book really was supposed to be Dick Nixon. He had a 5 o'clock shadow, he was waving 2 V's for victory. The kid had a little tape recorder for crying out loud. To recap, the Pope loves The Simpsons, yet it's my sweet children's book that's getting censored. And who are the people making these rulings? That's not a rhetorical question. No one knows who the people are in Texas who decide what children can read. But I figured out 3 things about the people who banned The Boy Who Looked Like Lincoln. They have no sense of history, they have no sense of humor, and they have filthy fucking minds. Did Steve Martin rip me off? The toughest thing about getting a children's book published is that you're competing with celebrity authors. There's Julie Andrews and Judy Collins, Kathy Lee Gifford and Jamie Lee Curtis, John Travolta and Lithgow, Queen Noor of Jordan and Sarah Ferguson. God help me, I'm fighting for shelf space with a queen and a duchess. And Madonna. Since stores arrange books by the author's last name, I find my work, by Reese, sandwiched between books by Carl Reiner and Leanne Rimes. What bothers me is that so many of these books aren't exactly books. Jerry Seinfeld and Jay Leno's stories are actually excerpts from their stand-up routines. David Byrne's children's book is just the lyrics from one of his songs, as is Neil Sedaka's. Then there's Steve Martin's first children's book, 2010's Late for School, the most charming book I've read since my 2003 book, Late for School. Both tell the story of a boy facing adventure on a mad dash for school. Both are written in verse. Both have the boy jumping over a pool. It rhymes with school. The biggest difference is that my book's final twist has the boy arriving at school right on time, and then, spoiler alert, realizing it's Sunday. In Steve Martin's book, it's Saturday. I'm not saying Steve Martin ripped off my book or even knew it existed. Steve Martin is a brilliant comedian, playwright, and novelist. I'm thrilled that we had the exact same idea and that I had it 7 years earlier. There is an upside to the celebrity domination of kiddie books. Recently, a publishing house called me in a panic. They had a children's book contract with an African-American superstar, and his manuscript was unusable, even by celebrity standards. I can't tell you his name, but he can play anything from a nutty professor to a Beverly Hills cop. They asked me, a Jewish kid from suburban Connecticut, to write a book about growing up as a poor black kid in the slums of New York. And they needed it the next day. I informed them huffily, a children's book is not a fast food hamburger, and I am not McDonald's. They said they'd pay me $10,000. I said, you want fries with that? If you still don't believe that the children's book business is sleazier than network TV, I submit this. I was commissioned to write a children's book by a New York department store, though I'm forbidden to say which one. The store was doing a big promotion on cashmere and wanted a storybook from the point of view of the goat who lived in the store. One more thing, they added. You won't get writing credit. The goat will. I didn't mind. It was a work for hire, and I cranked it out pretty quickly. The store loved it, too, except for my original title, Sax and the Single Goat. Whoops, what a giveaway. The book came out beautifully and was sold at all the stores in the chain. My name wasn't on it. Instead, it said it was written by the goat, quotes, and Terry Schuster. Terry Schuster? Who the hell is Terry Schuster? He was the vice president of the store. He even dedicated the book to his kids. At least I think they're his kids. Maybe someone else did that work for him, too. Chapter 16. Gay for Pay. Okay, I'll be perfectly blunt here. My favorite project I've ever worked on isn't The Simpsons, The Critic, or any of those great animated films. It's a little web series I created called Queer Duck, with the tagline, "He can't even fly straight." The show was born in 2000, in the year of the great dot-com boom and bust. My friends had started a company called Icebox and would feature a new online cartoon every day. The company was literally ahead of its time. These were the days of dial-up internet, and it took 20 minutes to download each 3-minute cartoon. Icebox offered no pay, just complete creative freedom, and most Simpsons writers jumped at that. Everyone got to write about topics that obsessed them. Jeff Martin did a series about Elvis and Jack Nicklaus solving mysteries. Dana Gould wrote about the Beach Boys' domineering father, Murray Wilson. And I dusted off a sketch I'd written in high school but never used, Hard Drinkin' Lincoln. This featured a snockered Abraham Lincoln at Ford's Theater loudly heckling the actors. When Abe finally gets shot, the audience cheers. Hard Drinkin' Lincoln was so popular, South Park ripped it off. That's a bold claim, but here's the case. I wrote an episode called Abezilla, where the statue in the Lincoln Memorial comes to life and goes on a rampage in Washington, D.C. To kill him, the army creates a giant John Wilkes Booth. Crazy idea, right? 6 months later, South Park, which shared a writer with Icebox, did the same story on its Super Best Friends episode. You can see both clips on YouTube. It's pretty blatant. I don't think it was an intentional theft. Things like this happen when you crank out a whole episode in just a week, as South Park does. It takes The Simpsons 36 weeks, minimum. Anyway, imitation is the sincerest form of felony. I followed up Hard Drinkin' Lincoln with a pet project called Queer Duck. Queer Duck was a cartoon about a gay duck, surprise, and his gay animal pals Openly Gator, Bipolar Bear, Oscar Wildcat, Truman Coyote, Kiangaroo Reeves, Ricky Marlin, and the questionably tasteful HIV Possum and Patient Zebra. Dan Castellaneta on Icebox. I know Mike did things for the internet, Hard Drinkin' Lincoln and Queer Duck. That's his real dark sense of humor. He just goes there. He doesn't worry about the line. He finds out about the line after he says what he says. I was listening to a podcast he was doing, and Gilbert Gottfried said, "Let me guess, you're Jewish." And Mike says, "Yes, I made a living modeling for hate literature." That's about as dark as you can go. Queer Duck made history as the first openly gay cartoon character. Now, I say openly gay because all cartoon characters are kind of gay. Bugs Bunny kisses Elmer Fudd on the mouth, Snagglepuss is theatrical, Daffy Duck has a lisp. Tweety Pie is Truman Capote. The Pink Panther, come on, it's so obvious. Donald Duck is a character right out of gay porn. He wears a sailor suit, but no pants. And Woody Woodpecker's name is a euphemism for erection-y-erection penis. The Simpsons, of course, has its gay characters, but Marge's sister Patty didn't come out of the closet till 5 years after Queer Duck. Not that she surprised anyone. Homer's reaction was, "Patty's gay? Here's another bomb! I like beer!" As for Smithers, it took him 27 years to finally admit he was gay, just like my cousin Lee. As silly and raunchy as it is, I created Queer Duck as an act of conscience. I read two troubling articles in the year 2000. One reported that Colorado had barred homosexuals from teaching in public schools. The other, that there were no gay characters on TV. None. This was before Glee and Will and Grace and Anderson Cooper and Rush Limbaugh. Oh my God, he just outed Rush Limbaugh. So I decided to redress these wrongs the only way I knew how. Through cartoons. The title came from a saying I used to hear as a kid, mostly about me. "That boy is a queer duck." It didn't imply homosexuality. A queer duck was just a weirdo. If the phrase had been queer mole, my cartoon would have been about a mole. By the way, if you develop a queer mole, see a doctor. People ask, "How do you write Queer Duck? You're not gay. You're bi." And the answer is no, I'm not gay. No, 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 1,000 times no. 3 times yes, but I was drunk. The first time. Seriously, I'm not gay, but I am Jewish, which is kind of the same thing. We've both been oppressed for centuries by our mothers. In truth, I did have some concerns about the project at first. I even told the folks at Icebox that if this ended up being perceived as gay bashing in any way, I'd pull the plug. I was doing this for gay people. I was giving them their own Bugs Bunny. I even offered to turn the whole thing over to a gay cartoon writer, of which there are many. But Icebox said it would be fine and just asked that we use a gay actor to voice Queer Duck. The first person who came into audition was Scott Thompson, the openly gay member of the hilarious Kids in the Hall comedy troupe and a mainstay of Gary Shandling's The Larry Sanders Show. I was very pleased to meet Scott until he started berating me loudly. It embodied all my worst fears about the project. How insensitive the script was, how dare I presume to write it. He chewed me out for 20 solid minutes, ending with a comment about my obviously Jewish appearance and asking, how would I like it if someone were to do something like this about Jews? Oy vey. And then, Scott Thompson proceeded to audition. He was even funny, but his reading sounded hostile. 2 days later, a friend saw Scott do stand-up. He was still angry, and his whole act was a tirade against this big-nosed guy doing a gay cartoon. Luckily for me, he was the last person to ever complain about Queer Duck. The next actor to audition was the buoyant and flamboyant Jim J. Bullock, who captured all the joy of the character. He got the part. It was an easy choice. The supporting cast was mostly very talented people I'd worked with before. Tress MacNeille from The Simpsons, Maurice LaMarche and Nick Jameson from The Critic, and even a veteran of Homeboys in Outer Space, Kevin Michael Richardson. The show was launched on October 11th, 2000, National Coming Out Day, and it immediately broke the dial-up internet. Viewership on Icebox.com spiked 400% and the website crashed. Clearly, the show filled a void. 2 days later, a reporter called to interview me from Germany. I knew people were loving it because there was a message board under the video saying things like, "Thank God, finally a cartoon for me." And when every once in a while we would receive a stupid comment like, "I hate this gay shit," I just thought, all right, if I make a homophobe angry, it's like making a homosexual happy. One day someone posted, "I wish this cartoon was around when I was 13. It would have made my life so much easier." To this day, that's the best review I ever got in my life. Queer Duck was such a hit it made the jump to the Showtime Network, airing after Queer as Folk, and Unknown to Me was shown weekly on Britain's Channel 4. In 2005, a poll of Channel 4 viewers named Queer Duck one of the 100 greatest cartoons of all time. Now, mind you, England is the world's only exclusively gay country. Britain's an island. It's like a big gay cruise that doesn't go anywhere. The response to Queer Duck has always been positive. I have a shelf full of awards from gay groups. At least I think they're awards. Many of them vibrate. GLAAD endorsed the series, and even Howard Stern praised it. There's the full spectrum right there, from GLAAD to Howard Stern. My brilliant director and designer Seth Feinberg said, "I've never gotten any email or heard someone who was offended. It seemed quite the opposite, actually. I'm surprised. I was expecting, 'You're insulting,' but I never got feedback like that." The media opportunities and interviews rolled in, and at first I kept my mouth shut about being straight. In the beginning, when journalists would come over to interview me, I would hide my wedding pictures and lock my wife in the bedroom. But then I came out of the closet and let Denise out of the bedroom, and everyone was fine with my not being gay. When the New York Times wrote about it, they said, "Queer Duck was created by Mike Reiss, who is straight." My father loved that. He never believed anything unless it was in the New York Times. How popular was Queer Duck? Well, he made appearances in two gay pride parades. One was in Los Angeles, and the other was in Springfield. In the 2002 Simpsons episode, Jaws Wired Shut, a giant Queer Duck balloon flew over Springfield's gay parade. Sadly, the scene was dropped, putting Queer Duck in that elite category of celebrity guests cut from The Simpsons for no friggin' reason. That list includes SCTV's brilliant Catherine O'Hara, John Cusack, John Turturro, and Aaron Sorkin. In 2005, I made a Queer Duck movie for Paramount Pictures. Variety called it the best animated film of the year, and the same year Brad Bird's Oscar-winning Ratatouille came out. I showed the film in Germany, and the audience laughed for 75 straight minutes, thereby doubling the total amount of time Germans have ever laughed. You can still buy the movie on DVD from Amazon. You get the full film, the original Icebox shorts, and a making-of documentary. Here's what you don't get. I had a song in the movie where all the gay animals are going to Disneyland. They sang, "Let's call Tom Cruise, what can we lose?" Paramount made me take that out because Tom Cruise sues anybody who calls him gay. So I changed the line to, "Forget Tom Cruise, call him gay and he sues." Paramount made me take that line out too. So I told this story in the making of documentary on the DVD. I said, "You can call anyone in the world gay except for Tom Cruise." Paramount told me to take that out too. When I asked why, they gave me a very Orwellian response. "It's against Paramount policy to discuss Paramount policy." Then the editor of the documentary had a great idea. He obscured my lips and futzed the audio in the making of documentary so that I said, "You can call anyone gay in the world you want except for blah, 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 blah." Paramount made me take that out too. When I asked why, they said, "Because everyone knows you're talking about Tom Cruise." Chapter 17. Writing for Humans Again. I spent the first 8 years of my career writing for real life people, if you count Alf and Joan Rivers. However, once you go toon, you won't be back soon, as no one has ever said. It's very liberating to write for cartoon characters because they don't take the jokes personally. Marge's sister can say, "Am I wrong or did it just get fatter in here?" And Dan Castellaneta's feelings are not hurt. Cruel lines fly freely on The Simpsons and our actors never take it to heart. Only once did a Simpsons actor resist a line. Hank Azaria didn't want to record Moe's response to a prank phone caller. "I'm a stupid moron with an ugly face and a big butt and my butt smells and I like to kiss my own butt." But eventually he did it. Contrast this with Roseanne, a great TV series about an elephant married to a hippopotamus. For 9 seasons, Roseanne insulted everyone in sight, but no one ever responded, "Shut up, fatso." No one ever seemed to notice her weight. Why? Because Roseanne was a human being, and it was her show. So it was with some trepidation that I went back to the world of writing for human beings. The results were mixed. Jokes for Bob Hope? Nope. The Pope. I wrote jokes for Johnny Carson, the Pope of late-night TV. But I also wrote gags for Pope Francis, the Johnny Carson of the Catholic Church. It started with my friend Ed Conlon, who's from a big Irish family. His aunts are all nuns, his uncles are priests, his mother's a nun, his father is also a nun. I was at a St. Patrick's Day party when I met Father Andrew, the Friar Tuckish head of Catholic Charities for New York. "You want to see the Pope's app?" he asked. At least I think he said app. The app was called Joke with the Pope and had videos of celebrities and nobodies telling jokes to Pope Francis. Through some mechanism I've never understood, this would benefit orphans in Cambodia and Venezuela. I could just picture the poor waif saying, "I sure like that joke George Lopez told the Pope, but I still rather have parents or pants." Father Andrew emailed me at midnight later that week. "We need a joke for Al Roker to tell the Pope. It needs to be about religion and weather, and it must be clean." I came up with this. The California drought is so bad, people in Napa are asking the Pope to change the wine into water. No one thinks that joke is funny. They always say it's cute. Cute, I realized, is an acronym for completely unable to entertain. But the joke made it to the app, so every few nights, Father Andrew would email me requesting jokes for Mayor Bloomberg, Conan O'Brien, David Copperfield, and on and on. There are 800 million Catholics on Earth, but somehow the church had to bother me. I was a Jew writing jokes for the Pope. For free. That's two sins. Still, Jesus relied on Jewish writers for his gospels, too. When the project finally wrapped, the charity threw itself a very lavish party, and to my complete surprise, I was presented with a plaque from Pope Francis naming me a missionary of joy. "Well," I quipped to the clergymen assembled, "this isn't the first time a priest has put a man in the missionary position. Next time, they should pay me." A half-life in the theater. After 35 years of working in movies and TV, I started writing plays. Why? Because after a while you get tired of earning money and having people see your work. I fell into theater by accident. My wife and I were in London and we saw a Playhouse showing Waiting for Godot, starring Ian McKellen and Michael Gambon. That's Gandalf and Dumbledore to you. The show was sold out, but we decided to stand on the ticket line, hoping for someone to cancel their tickets. We waited for 2 hours, but never got in. "Couldn't this be a play?" I asked my wife. Waiting for Godot? My wife said, "Nah, but I wrote it anyway. I even got my friend's sister, a theater director, to stage the show." The one-act play opens as Dave arrives at a theater showing Waiting for Godot, and it's sold out. He calls his wife as another man listens. "Honey, I couldn't get tickets. Is there another show you want to see?" "What's that?" "Go fuck yourself?" It sounded like you said, "Go fuck yourself." Dave explains to the other man, "That's the new David Mamet play." This opening joke got an enormous laugh, much better than it deserved, and I was hooked. Theater was easy, the audiences were generous, and the actors did every line I wrote. I learned this during my first full-length play, I'm Connecticut, which won every award you can win in Connecticut. The play featured a tough-talking Massachusetts guy who says, "In Boston, we call a milkshake a frap." "A frap, what's that?" "It's crap with a f." "And we call ice cream sprinkles Jimmies." "Who the hell is Jimmy?" Every night the actor would end the speech, "Who's the hell is Jimmy?" I liked it. It didn't make much sense, but it was good character. When the play finally closed, I checked the script. It was a typo. In theater, the actors do your typos. My rep in ruins. After visiting half the countries on Earth, I was able to put my world travel to good use. In 2009, I wrote a sweet little romantic comedy film called My Life in Ruins. It was about a bus tour of Greece, and it had big laughs, gorgeous scenery, and a simple message. Don't judge others too harshly. One critic called it execrable. I was fully prepared for bad reviews, but nothing quite this vicious. Sledgehammer star David Rashi, who'd been in a critically trashed play, tried to spin it. Execrable can mean deserving to be excreted. See? Deserving. That's good. Or it can mean of poorest quality. Okay, see? Quality. That is also very good. I was surprised because my film was the highest testing movie in Fox Searchlight history. Audiences liked it more than, say, Little Miss Sunshine and Slumdog Millionaire, but not the critics. They called it one big fat Greek disaster, wretched, thuddingly bad, a film that will kill Greek tourism, and a steaming pile of stereotypes and sitcomery, a pathetic excuse for a comedy. That last review sent my wife to a sick bed for 3 days with what Victorian doctors used to call the vapors. Roger Ebert, who'd guest starred on my show The Critic, called me an imbecile. Other critics singled me out, calling me an idiot and subliterate. Now, I opened that film with an allusion of Voltaire. A sign reads, Pangloss Tours, the best of all possible worlds. In Candide, Dr. Pangloss utters these optimistic words before his group sets out on an utterly disastrous journey. Just like the tourists in my film. Get it? The critics didn't. Not one caught the allusion. Otherwise, they'd have called me a subliterate moron who reads Voltaire. We all have to deal with criticism in this world, but only people in entertainment have to deal with critics. You may get a performance review at work that reads, Jim's efficiency in processing claims is down 11%. Needs improvement. If it read, Jim's work recalls a drooling monkey who can't tell a banana from a ballpoint pen, well, you'd have grounds for a lawsuit. I can't speak for all writers, but for me, bad reviews hurt. I can still quote you every nasty write-up I've gotten over the past 35 years. Why shouldn't I? I try my best on everything I do, and my works are my babies. I don't want Manola Dargis coming to my home and saying, Mike Reiss's newest offering, Mike Jr., is a babbling, bloated sequel to the thoroughly unpleasant original. Avoid this soggy diaper of a child. My movie was panned and my book was banned. I needed to retreat to a safe space. It was time to head back to The Simpsons. Chapter 18. Back to the old tire fire. I'd spent a few years away from The Simpsons, dabbling in different projects, and in that time I had the pleasure of watching the show each week as a fan. I no longer knew what was coming in every episode, which was a treat. Most importantly, it solidified what I had believed all along. The Simpsons was great. In fact, it may have been better without me. Then in season 12, the wonderful showrunner Mike Scully called and asked if I wanted to return to the series one day a week as a consultant. I jumped at the chance. Scully had been the Henry Ford of the series, streamlining production, delegating authority, and turning The Simpsons into something it had never been before, a 9-to-5 job. Up to that point, the show's hours had always been insane, and writers quit the second they had the chance. It was great to be working with Al Jean again. He'd gone back to The Simpsons in 1997, right after the cancellation of Teen Angel. But for the most part, I was working with a room full of strangers. They were all very talented writers, but they weren't a group of old friends like the original staff. It was no longer collegial. It was like high school. There was gossip, cliques, and an awful lot of backbiting. At times, the nastiness would leach into the show. Like when Bart strangled Homer with a phone cord and beat him unconscious with the receiver. Or when Mr. Burns threw fish guts at orphans on Christmas. Or when Milhouse's father had his arm cut off by a piece of piano wire. The shows were always funny, but they could also get pretty dark. I wasn't having fun and thought about